cooks when they see someone cut down in their pants. It may not show when you look at me, but I know I'm in mine now. I'm potent, baby, I'm potent, dangerous in the naked eye. Raise your head on this bed of mother's pride to find out why. Don't you wanna take me home? Don't you wanna take me home? Give me a sense of purpose, a real sense of purpose now. Give me a sense of purpose, a real sense of purpose now.
Over the mountain, down in the valley, lives a former talk show host. Everybody knows his name.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Today marks the debut of a California-wide ad blitz targeting Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's proposed healthcare industry changes. The governor has been in a heated battle with the California Nurses Association ever since he announced changes to staffing rules. Schwarzenegger used emergency action to freeze scheduled changes in nurse staffing ratios that would have assigned fewer patients per nurse. The 60,000-member union says that the changes will be harmful to patients. The ad will debut tonight in every major California cable market during a movie about Schwarzenegger's life.
The Kansas Association of Public Employees says Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius is allowing illegal anti-union activities against state employees. Betty Vines heads the employee association. She says her union has filed two formal complaints with the state labor board in Kansas in an effort to halt what she calls management intimidation tactics against the union.
I think it's kind of ironic that we're willing to send people all over the world to fight for other people's rights, and yet we constantly, from national on down, see our citizens being denied rights that should come to them easily, you know, and that they have to have somebody, a union or association, to be there to fight for them daily to make sure that they aren't denied those rights.
Vines says her union won't tolerate intimidation and interference from the state when it comes to the labor rights of state workers.
As garbage workers rallied in Hamilton Township, New Jersey yesterday, their company prepared to start hiring permanent replacement workers. Workers represented by the Teamsters have been striking against Waste Management Incorporated for 22 days, with no date set to resume contract negotiations. The company warned strikers last week that if they didn't accept the company's latest offer, they would face the possibility of being replaced. This week, the company began collecting job applications for permanent replacement workers. Teamsters officials say that because the strike is an unfair labor practices action, the workers are protected from being replaced. The National Labor Relations Board has not yet classified the strike. If the NLRB rules it economic, the workers could be replaced. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Alabama saw a growth spurt in union membership during 2004. Government figures show that 9.7% of Alabama workers belonged to a union in 2004, up from 8.1% in 2003. Nationally, there has been a decline in union membership from 12.9% in 2003 to 12.5% last year. Many states, especially in the South, have seen organizing decrease as plants close and jobs go overseas.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Oh, cruel fate. Have pity on the poor CEOs of corporate world. One day they're strutting peacocks. The next day, they're feather dusters. Several CEOs who've recently had their plumage plucked are in the news again, this time facing trial for various levels of fraud. Kenneth Lay of Enron, Dennis Kozlowski of Tyco, Bernie Ebers of WorldCom, Richard Scrushy of HealthSouth, and Walter Forbes of CUC International are among the former CEOs who once were heralded in business magazines, management books, and the popular media as giants, geniuses, and gurus, the gods of corporate success. Only a couple of years ago, these gentlemen of the executive suite were giving lectures on how to run a modern corporation. Now, they're in the dock. Not only have these gods tumbled from the heights, but their legal defense is that they were never really in charge of their corporations and knew nothing about the multi-billion-dollar heist taking place on their watch. It's the dummy defense. Lay, for example, now says that, golly, while he once took credit for Enron's success, he really can't be responsible for its collapse since he wasn't involved in the details of corporate management. Likewise, Walter Forbes says he was uninvolved in CUC's day-to-day operations because, as CEO, he had his head in the clouds, focusing on, quote, the strategy vision part. The same with Ebers. WorldCom's hotshot chief asserts that he knew nothing about the $11 billion insider fraud that devoured his company, for he left all the arithmetic to his financial people. Even though he has previously claimed credit for being a hands-on financial detail man who made WorldCom a success. This is Jim Hightower saying, odd that these guys who raked in the big bucks for being in charge now claim to have been management dummies and victims of conniving underlings. Odder yet, not one of them offers to give back the loot they took.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live. There's your volume control, Louise. Broadcasting live from Palm Springs, California, the Winter Brain Conference, the last day of the conference. I'll be flying back to Vermont immediately thereafter, and back in the fine People's Republic tonight. Ready to go back on the air tomorrow, live from the from Montpelier. Right now, Rama Schneider, ably running the board, managing the engineering end of the program in Vermont. Ira Gravatt answering the telephones and screening calls, keeping all the other technical stuff running. And thank you very much to both of you for being there, and Louise producing the program here. Anyhow, so much has happened over the last weekend, but really the big story is the. Or a big story. There's Iraq stuff we'll get to and other things as well. But a big story right now, of course, is the president's budget just came out. And I think what's particularly fascinating about this is that what we are seeing now, actually, let me just rephrase that. What I find most fascinating about it is the fact that nobody's talking about what we're really seeing now. And that is that there is this very significant divide in America between, you could say, liberals and conservatives. Frankly, I would say between conservative extremists and pretty much the rest of America about what role government should play in the lives of our citizens. And this debate is being played out as well in Europe. We're going to get to that in a little bit. What's going on in France? What happened in France over the weekend? Huge protests there. Yeah, and it's happening all over the world. I wrote about this in an op-ed piece a week or so ago in Common Dreams. We talked about it briefly on the program. And what we're seeing is this ideological divide. That, as I said, that nobody is talking about in the media. They're just dealing with it like, well, this is the administration, this is what they're doing. But there is this major divide between those folks who believe that the needs of the country, as the country gets larger, as things become more complex, as more and more poisons are generated by industry, let's assume with the best of intentions. I mean, we're trying to develop drugs that are going to heal people and plastics that are going to, synthetic materials that are going to make for lighter cars and save fuel and developing alternative energy sources that require toxic metals in many cases for catalytic processes and things like that. As more toxins come into our environment, as superbugs are evolving, as the possibility of bird flu that could kill, I mean, right now it seems to be killing about 70% of the people who it infects, is looming on the horizon, as SARS, has been beaten back but might make a resurgence. As the world becomes more complex and all these things that we think of as negatives, and all the positives as well, all the extraordinary opportunities, developing alternative energy sources, having communities create their own local power generation, giving people the ability to take greater responsibility for their own health care. As all of these things are happening, at the same time that our population is growing and our economy is changing continuously, I mean, it's the old Grace Slick line, from the... Engines of Creation album, life is change, how it differs from the rocks, right? As all of this is going on, and has gone on for the last 200 years in this country, Americans, by and large, have said, okay, as things are getting more dangerous, they're getting more complicated, they're getting more confusing, there's a lot that we just can't attend to. For example, I can't go to the supermarket and say, okay, I happen to know that vegetable there is not infected with E. coli, whereas the vegetables next to it are. Because I can't tell by looking at them. E. coli is the fecal bacteria that you get in food when it's been irrigated by water contaminated by sewage, which is very common in third world countries. And we import a lot of food from third world countries. So it has to be very rigorously scrubbed, right? So I don't have the ability to look at food in the supermarket and say, okay, I know that that's contaminated and that's not. So what we have said, and that's just, one of hundreds of examples. What we have said is that we the people collectively, all of us together, we the people are getting together and saying, we would like to have some folks on our behalf, our employees, answerable to us, responsive to us. We would like to have them take care of some of these things so we don't have to get so hysterical about them, so we don't have to be so worried about them. We would like them to be noticing, what's safe and what's not safe, to be making sure that our waters are clean, that our sewage gets disposed of properly, that our rivers are intact, that our wild areas have some semblance of wildness to them, that criminals are appropriately treated in jail so that when they come out they're not worse than when they went in, that sentencing is appropriate, on and on it goes, that our veterans are taken care of, that the weakest and poorest among us, now that it's our communities are so large, it's so difficult, that for us to take care of these folks. It used to be hundreds of years ago, you lived in a small town, a few hundred people. Somebody got sick, everybody would bring food over. It's still that way in some places. In the little town where I live, in Montpelier, Vermont, the capital of Vermont, 8,900 people, a dear friend of ours got cancer a few years ago. It's been 6 years now. She's officially cured. So that's the good news. But she got cancer, and she had to do chemotherapy. She had breast cancer. One of our very closest friends. And every night, and this was like this ad hoc thing that got organized by just people in the community. It wasn't her idea to put this together. Just some friends of theirs put this thing together where every night for about 6 months, somebody made dinner and brought it over for the family because her husband was working mega hours. I mean, they were both working. She had to take time off work. She was very, very sick. And so he was working all this extra time, and then their kid, they had three kids in school. So everybody pitched in. Well, that's the, you know, that's the ideal. I mean, that's what George Bush would like us to, he would like to say, well, that's what we should be doing. We should be just kind of tossing it all back to the communities and the churches and whatnot. And it's possible in a little tiny town. It's possible in a little tiny town. But as America has grown larger and more of us are living in cities and suburbs and people don't know their neighbors, it's just not possible. So what we have said is, rather than, you know, just doing this collectively together, we'll all toss a few bucks into the pot and make sure that it gets done. And we're going to hire some folks to do this. That's called government. And see, this is the great divide, the great debate that we're seeing in the president's budget, and that is between those folks who have historically believed that government of, by, and for the people, that the American form of government appropriately should play some role in people's lives, some positive, proactive, helpful, useful, nurturing, supporting role on the one hand, and that's the majority of Americans. You look at any survey, the majority of Americans, they want Social Security intact, they want Medicare, they want, actually, more than 78% of Americans want national health care. Okay, so the majority of it, this is the majority. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, the right-wing cranks, the so-called conservatives, who say, no, sorry, the only legitimate function of government is to run the military and the police. And they view government not as a nurturing parent, but as an angry father, as a wrathful, vengeful, you know, protective force purely in that capacity. This is really the debate that's breaking down. This is where it's coming apart, or this is how it's being, you know, this is how it's being fought out. And we're seeing that now in the president's budget. That George Bush and Dick Cheney and the members of his administration, Grover Norquist, all these cons, all these right-wingers that you hear on right-wing talk radio, this is a 25-year campaign. It's a campaign that goes back far beyond that. This same thing happened from the 1880s to 1929. The right wingers took over the country, and you had this huge, huge population of Americans living in poverty. The average wage of what seemed to resemble something like a middle class back then was around, in today's dollars, around $9,000 a year for a family of four. So the majority of the country lived in what today would be considered poverty. And then FDR came along and he said, no, government can play a role in these things. Now, where liberals agree with conservatives is neither one of us particularly want government in our bedrooms, listening to our telephone conversations, following us around. And again, that demonstrates that the Bush administration, these folks are not conservatives. They're extremists, right-wing extremists. Some would say neo-fascists. So anyway, we're going to get into looking at this budget. Just in overview, but I think it's so important to keep it in context, in the context of what's really going on here. What's the real agenda? What are these guys really up to? And before we get into that, by the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number is 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to call in, be on the program today. Our website, tomhartman.com. You can drive into our live chat room. I'm not able to participate in the chat room today because it tends to crash my computer, and that's what's keeping me connected to Rama there in Vermont and beaming the signal back to Denver where it goes up to the satellite where it comes down to the radio station you're hearing it from. I'm sure the gang is there. So I say hi to you. Hi. Hello to the folks in the chat room. 1-866-889-8894. Before we take a break, let's go to the phone lines here for a quick call. John in Long Island, New York on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? I have some information for you on a worldwide protest of the anti-war movement.
Yes, sir.
Against George Bush and his administration. On Central Park on March 19th is going to be one of the rallies, trying to get Bush out of office on all the issues that we have before us. Here's one thing. A few months ago, Mayor Bloomberg, New York Police Department, and Bush absolutely said we cannot use the park for a protest. And
right.
The American people and New Yorkers are not going to stand for this, and we will take over the park on March 19th.
Oh, that's interesting.
And if you go to the people, what is it, the peoplejudgebush.org and moveon.org, you'll get a lot of information about it.
Okay, John, I'm curious. You said to try and get Bush out of office. What? How?
I don't know, but right here you have a thing that says, hear the testimony the people will judge. There's a little check mark that says, yes, I will vote Bush guilty on war crimes. Reject the administration of war criminal.
Martin, yeah, you know, this is there's actually a worldwide movement about this suggesting
that.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks for the tip, John. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's, people talk about let's impeach Bush. Then you get Cheney, right? You impeach Cheney, you get Castor. I mean, the whole bunch of them. We need to get them out in the ballot box. That's where we need to be getting them out. We need to be preparing for 2006, although it's really important to be also speaking out as John did. We'll be right back.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oric, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oric XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So in Omaha, George W. Bush is showing up for one of his carefully scripted events. We thought perhaps after the election he'd actually go out and talk to the people, but no. Those folks who are not registered Republicans or hadn't signed loyalty oaths or hadn't sworn fealty to him were not allowed in. So it was another suck-up audience. It's just like that guy from the Talon News Service, you know, the Republican operative who constantly always gets asked a question by George Bush, and he stands up and says, well, those Democrats are trying to destroy. And Bush goes, yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. And it turns out the guy's not even a reporter. He's just a shill for the Republicans, and they've got him in the press pool so that he can always ask the good question, right? Well, Bush shows up in Omaha, and somehow, Mary Mornin snuck through. And actually, it turns out, apparently, she is a Republican and a loyal and enthusiastic supporter of Bush and all that. But somehow she got through. In Omaha on Friday, this from a story in the Washington Post, in Omaha on Friday, a divorced single mother named Mary Mornin told the president, quote, I have one child, Robbie, who is mentally challenged, and I have two daughters. Fantastic, the president exclaims, and tells her that she has the hardest job in America, being a single mom. Later, the 57-year-old Mornin tells Bush that she works three jobs to pay for her mentally challenged child and her two daughters, keep them alive, keeping them going to school. She has to work three jobs. George Bush says, that's uniquely American. That's fantastic. And he makes a joke. He asks her if she gets any sleep. He thinks this is funny. I'm telling you, we talked about this in the third hour of the program. I think it was last Friday. Maybe it was Thursday. About that. And I'm not going to retell the story about it, but the story, those of you who heard it, the story about when Bobby Kennedy got his aha, when he came face to face with the reality, the ugly reality of discrimination and poverty in the United States and how it transformed him and his life. I am increasingly convinced that George Bush has never come close to one of those moments, that the reality of the lives of the vast majority of Americans are simply abstractions. They're just technical language. They're just vague, distant, black and white stories, old newsreels for the people in this administration. George Bush has put forth a $2.57 trillion budget plan. Counts on a healthy economy to boost revenues by 6.1%. So first of all of his projections about, hey, we're going to balance the budget here by the time, you know, get it, cut it in half, right, cut in half the deficit. No plans to get it actually balanced like Bill Clinton did. No, that would mean that he'd have to roll back the tax cuts for the rich, but ain't going to do that. No, sirree, Bob, not so long as he's making millions. And his daddy's making millions, and his buddies are making millions, and his campaign donors are making millions, and Dick Cheney's making millions, and Don Rumsfeld's making... No, sorry, Bob! No tax cuts for the rich, no. Anyhow, outside of defense, Homeland Security, this is from the AP this morning, Social Security, Bush, outside of those, Bush proposes cutting spending for the rest of the government by about 0.5%, the first such proposed cut since the Reagan administration battled with its own soaring deficits. You will recall Reagan ended up having to raise taxes 5 out of his 8 years. Of 23 major governmental agencies, 12 would see their budget authority reduced next year, including cuts of 9.6% at agriculture. Most of that axe is going to fall over $1.1 billion on food stamps for poor people. At 5.6% at the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, after all, you know, we need to cut back the EPA. They're just keeping the air clean. They're just making sure that there's not poison in the water. And, you know, as they do their job, it costs some industries a little extra money, and the Bush administration isn't all that happy about the EPA, really. I mean, Nixon, everybody says, all right, Nixon signed the EPA into law in 1972, you know, as a result of Rachel Carlson's silent spring back in 62. But it was the Democratic Congress that put the thing together and put it on Nixon's desk and said, you know, you sign it or it's political suicide. So he eagerly took credit for it. Well, Bush is going to undo that one, too. On it goes. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Love rules.
Our son gets mad. He tries to shout.
We'll take away his cell phone, his video game.
And if we have to, we'll take away his freedom.
He's got to understand that there will be consequences for breaking our rules.
It doesn't matter that he's not smoking. When we say not to hang out with the weed crowd,
we mean it.
That's what it takes to keep him away from marijuana.
And we love him enough to live with that.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Today marks the debut of a California-wide ad blitz targeting Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's proposed healthcare industry changes. The governor has been in a heated battle with the California Nurses Association ever since he announced changes to staffing rules. Schwarzenegger used emergency action to freeze scheduled changes in nurse staffing ratios that would have assigned fewer patients per nurse. The 60,000-member union says that the changes will be harmful to patients. The ad will debut tonight in every major California cable market during a movie about Schwarzenegger's life.
The Kansas Association of Public Employees says Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius is allowing illegal anti-union activities against state employees. Betty Vines heads the employee association. She says her union has filed two formal complaints with the state labor board in Kansas in an effort to halt what she calls management intimidation tactics against the union.
I think it's kind of ironic that we're willing to send people all over the world to fight for other people's rights, and yet we constantly, from national on down, see our citizens being denied rights that should come to them easily, you know, and that they have to have somebody, a union or association, to be there to fight for them daily to make sure that they aren't denied those rights.
Vines says her union won't tolerate intimidation and interference from the state when it comes to the labor rights of state workers.
As garbage workers rallied in Hamilton Township, New Jersey yesterday, their company prepared to start hiring permanent replacement workers. Workers represented by the Teamsters have been striking against Waste Management Incorporated for 22 days with no date set to resume contract negotiations. The company warned strikers last week that if they didn't accept the company's latest offer, they would face the possibility of being replaced. This week, the company began collecting job applications for permanent replacement workers. Teamsters officials say that because the strike is an unfair labor practices action, the workers are protected from being replaced. The National Labor Relations Board has not yet classified the strike. If the NLRB rules it economic, the workers could be replaced. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Alabama saw a growth spurt in union membership during 2004. Government figures show that 9.7% of Alabama workers belonged to a union in 2004, up from 8.1% in 2003. Nationally, there has been a decline in union membership from 12.9% in 2003 to 12.5% last year. Many states, especially in the South, have seen organizing decrease as plants close and jobs go overseas.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. of 23 major agencies, as we mentioned, 12 are going to see their budget authority reduced next year. Now, I think all of us, everybody, is opposed to government waste. Nobody wants to see their tax dollars wasted. That's not something that, you know, anybody... Oh, yes, take my tax dollars at the barrel of a gun. Because it is compulsory, you know, you must pay. Yes, take my tax dollars and just give them to your friends in the Carlyle Group or build another cotton fluff museum someplace in Arkansas or whatever. I mean, there is a lot of pork out there. Oddly, it appears that this budget is not attacking the pork. Why? Well, because it's political suicide. The Republicans need that pork. In fact, one of the things that we learned out of the election of 2004 was that the so-called red states, the Republican states, receive more tax dollars from Washington, D.C. than they pay in tax dollars. And the so-called blue states, the Democratic states, pay more in tax dollars than they receive from Washington, D.C. Now, why would that be? Well, it's very simple. At the moment, and it's probably been the reverse in the past when Democrats were in control. I mean, this is a game both parties play. That at the moment, the Republicans control appropriations and spending. I mean, they control Congress. And so they reach into that pork barrel and they say, we'll build a new, you know, whatever in our district, and that'll make some jobs and it'll make people happy. And so more and more spending is going to Republican areas because Republicans control the spending process, and less to Democratic areas because they're not in control. And as I said, this is just, you know, this is the nature of the beast. This is why it is so useful, whether you lean toward Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, whatever. This is why it's so useful that we actually have a true, effective, functional, adversarial system in our government. You know, where you've got at least a second party at least represented in one house of Congress or the White House. In other words, see, when all three are gone, plus the Supreme Court, I mean, when all four are gone, the House, the Senate, the White House, and the Supreme Court, when all four of them are controlled by one party, there's no restraint. There's no restraint. And so you get these outrageous situations like this budget. You know, the New York Times today, Bush budget raises drug prices for many veterans. President Bush's budget would more than double the copayment charge to many veterans for prescription drugs and would require some to pay a new fee of $250 a year for the privilege of using government health care. We're being tight, Vice President Cheney said on Fox News Sunday. Yeah, for the poor, not for the Carlyle Group, not for Halliburton, but yeah, for the poor. Somehow we've misplaced $9 billion in Iraq. Misplaced $9 billion! Nobody's looking for that. Instead, we're going to cut $1 billion out of food stamps. Instead, we're going to tell our veterans, you don't pay $250 a year to participate in the program, you can't get any care whatsoever. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot of money to the average person. Probably most of you listening to this program, $250, that's not a lot of money. About a third of the homeless men in the United States are Vietnam War veterans. They're a burden on the system. The vast majority of them are homeless as a result of largely psychological wounds of the Vietnam War. We're seeing this from Gulf War victims. Over 300,000 Gulf War victims. Many of them are now homeless, who are on full disability. They are expensive to care for, these wars that we've had, caring for our warriors. And the homeless ones won't be able to come up with the $250, may not even read the newspapers and know that they have to. So when they show up, they just get kicked out. And, gee, all of a sudden, our costs for health care for veterans have gone down. Because we're just going to let these folks die. Welcome to Bush World. Let's take a couple more phone calls here. 1-866-889-8840. 8894, our telephone number. Patrick in Iowa is on the line. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I didn't even, let's say, know your name or were familiar with you until about 3 weeks ago. And I happened to read a little bit of an article. It was in the Internet. And I looked up some of your writings, and I went to the library. And I did get, some books on ADD because my daughter is ADD.
Uh-huh.
And I also got The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever read any writings, sir, that were more explicit, more condensed, yet more to the point than yours are and more fulfilling. And I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Patrick. That's very kind of you. I actually gave a talk on that topic, more or less, here at this Winter Brain Conference. It's interesting because it doesn't have anything to do with neurology, but neurologists are interested in all kinds of things. So, yeah, thank you. So what's up?
The other thing that I wanted to say was this. Concerning, let's say, Bush's budget.
Yes, sir.
It's becoming almost as ominous as saying something else, but we'll say that way. I don't think you mentioned the cut that is going to occur within education. Because I read the New York Times this morning, and I also read the Washington Post very thoroughly.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to it yet, Patrick. I've got about a half inch of paper here in front of me, and I've only gone through the first two pages.
Tom, the cuts that are going to occur in education alone are going to be astronomical, and we cannot, as a nation, stand cuts in education because education has proven to be the backbone of any civilization and has helped them the most.
Yeah, well, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out, you cannot have a functional democracy without an educated populace. It is absolutely necessary. And now we have a situation where, for example, last week this study was published that showed that 36% of American high school seniors believe that the government either A, regularly does censor the newspapers before they're published every morning, or B, appropriately should do so. And the state of knowledge about democracy and civics is just truly shocking in the United States, and this administration wants to make it worse. And I think it's because a dumb people, an uneducated people, people who don't understand their history, are a docile people.
And one last factor on it, and then I'll be off the air on this whole thing. But
I've
contacted as many, let's say, radio stations as possible in the last full week. Just to find out if they carried your program here in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, we're not on the air in that state,
none.
Other than Sirius Satellite Radio.
I know, none. That's the only way that I'm being able to pick you up is through the computer that I have right here.
Yeah.
And that's the pathetic part, and they don't even have a true interpretation of who you are, what you're providing, or what, let's say, enlightenment you might therefore show for the young people, but also for the people who actually listen to you.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you,
Patrick,
sir, and I hope you the best.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for the call. I do appreciate it. And thanks for your kind words. If you find a station in Iowa that would be interested in carrying our program, let us know. We will take it from there. The program is growing. We are on radio stations literally from California and Oregon to North Carolina and West Virginia and scattered throughout the country in between. And the program is growing on a regular basis, both on terrestrial radio stations and on the Internet. And, of course, we're on Sirius Satellite Radio, which is coast-to-coast as well. And on the Internet, that's an interesting phenomenon. We're up to listeners now in 116 countries regularly listening to the program. So, it's remarkable. You go to our message board, and the number of people from all over the world who are on the message board participating, people talking about American politics from Australia, from Austria, from New Zealand, from South Africa, from, and on and on it goes. Anyway, Xavier in Santa Cruz on the line. Hey, Xavier, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Yeah, this isn't my point, but I was just at a Democratic group over the weekend, a new one that's forming, and nobody there had heard of you, and I turned them on to you here in Santa Cruz.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. But they showed the George Lakoff video. It's kind of what you were talking about earlier about and that's what I wanted to do. My point was I saw this video, and they mentioned the strict father.
Yes.
And the nurturing parent?
Yeah, I actually, every month I do a book of the month for BuzzFlash. It's mm-hmm. Tom Hartman's Independent Thinkers Book of the Month Club. And 2 or 3 months ago, the recommended book of the month was Lakoff's video along with his book Don't Think of an Elephant.
Right,
I've written a review of that. You can find on BuzzFlash.com.
Well, my point, I wanted to ask you about this, see what you thought of it. When I saw, first they mentioned the strict father, and then I was waiting for the next one, and they said the nurturing, and my next word was going to be mother. But they didn't say mother, they said parent, and I found
that kind of curious.
And
well, he says family.
Oh, family, okay. Well, some, in the book it says parent, but he'd use those two interchangeably.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, I thought possibly the reason they were doing that is they didn't want to stereotype women as nurturing or something.
I think it goes beyond that. There's this concept of, I mean, literally, of the nurturing family, of an entire family, not just even the two parents, but the extended family, the entire community. That's the quote liberal worldview, is that there is this nurturing family, and that government plays a role in that context, as it is part of us and we are part of it. When it's appropriately run. Now, the most hysterical of the conservatives, who are very, very worried about government power and government, you know, creeping up and all that kind of thing, have a lot of very legitimate points to make. When you look at governments that are not democratic republics, if you look at, for example, the government of the Soviet Union, or I remember the first time I went into East Germany, back when it was East Germany, and there was, you know, I had a guy following me around everywhere I went, the secret police, the Stasi. But if the United States is functioning the way it's supposed to, that's not what we're about. And unfortunately, you know, we are moving in that direction in some ways.
The point I'm wanting to make is that I'm a fairly progressive on into green, but I do have some libertarian angles to me too. And I'm seeing the reason why we don't bring more men into this progressive movement is that. They tend to marginalize them, and I'm thinking when we refer to the angry or strict father figure, I think we should say parent, and you know, kind of try to be egalitarian about that.
I don't disagree. Margaret Thatcher was she could out Reagan.
Yeah.
This is not a quality that is limited to men. Or Ann Coulter, for example, another one, assuming that she was actually as a woman. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, this is a delicate subject. I don't want to be.
Although I think I just let me just toss this in. I do think that, you know, he was also making the point that these political systems tend to be aligned with patriarchal, patrilineal, hierarchical, male dominated religious systems. Right. So, but in any case.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I don't want to be harping on this because I tend to be the only one that brings this up in a group, and I do realize that women get the short end of the stick a lot. I just want to bring this to the table, too, and I don't hear other people doing it, so I tend to be doing it a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks, Xavier. I appreciate the call. Okay. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Here, the budget, the smoke and mirrors of this budget. We'll get into this in some more detail, but this is just absolutely remarkable. The entire thing depends on phony numbers. This is in today's Los Angeles Times. The Bush's deficit plan is all in the math. The federal deficit will be, Bush says he's going to cut the federal deficit in half by the time he leaves office in 4 years. Well, technically. Although Isabel Sawhill, director of the Brookings Institution's economic studies think tank, says it doesn't quite compute. First of all, the deficit that he says he's going to cut in half is not the $412 billion, which was actually the deficit for the 2004 year. It's the $521 billion that the OMB a year earlier had said 2004 was going to be. In other words, 2 years ago, the OMB said, hey, you know, it looks like you're headed down the road to a $512 billion deficit. It wasn't quite so bad. It was 420 some odd. Now, that, of course, didn't include the money borrowed from Social Security, and it didn't include much of the Iraq costs. But nonetheless, it didn't look so bad. But he's using the old projection estimate numbers and saying, we're going to cut that in half. So it starts out with nonsense numbers. Then they say, but there's more. Bush proposes to cut the deficit in half, not in dollars, but as a share of the economy. So he's assuming certain growth estimates that may or may not play out. They're very rosy estimates. And then, but there's more! The cost of Iraq and Afghanistan wars will not be included in the budget. But there's more! Nor will the cost of introducing private investment accounts to Social Security, $754 billion over the first 10 years alone, be found in the budget. That cost, according to Dick Cheney, will be borrowed. Yes, that's going to take care of everything. On the tax side, the budget is not expected to show the effect of the proposed curb to the alternative minimum tax. Bush is saying, let's do away with the alternative minimum tax or cut back on it. This is the, when it was originally proposed, was the tax for rich folks who got out of paying taxes, basically. And it's starting to hit the upper end of the middle class. And Bush's suggestion to cut this is going to add $44 billion to the deficit. That's not in the budget either. But there's more! But as a share of the nation's economic output, tax payments to the government fell to 16.3% last year, the lowest level since 1959. Now, all of this is predicated on the assumption that we're going to have tax revenues that have been looking like past years. But no, now we're back down to 1959. And in 1959, the LA Times points out, the government was not paying for Medicare, which cost $297 billion in last year, Medicaid, $176 billion last year, food stamps, $29 billion last year, space program, $15 billion last year. Grover Norquist defines the difference. He says, the fundamental difference between the two parties is how big the government should be. I disagree because these guys are actually increasing the size of government, largely through the military and through increasing internal police powers. Really, the difference between the two parties is what is the job of government? What is the role of government? This is Tom Hartman with you. We'll be back right after this.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the Southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
In some parts of the world, a shortage of protein leads to an abundance of poaching. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. People and wildlife are suffering from severe overfishing in the waters of West Africa. Researchers say the fishery has been depleted as a result of overexploitation, and people can no longer rely on fish to get cheap protein into their diets. People are turning to animal meat as a replacement, and they're getting it by poaching in wildlife reserves. Justin Prechers is a wildlife ecologist at the University of California in Berkeley. He studied the rise and fall of fish populations off the coast of Ghana during the past 30 years. Ghana is on Africa's Atlantic coast, and people there have depended on fish for generations. Prechers says the importance of this fishery stretches from the Atlantic coast to the edge of the Sahara Desert.
It's actually when you get much further inland, in some cases even into sub-desert or desert communities, hundreds, in some cases 1,000 miles from the coast, where you realize that it's these smoked or dried fish, particularly these small sardines and anchovy-type things, that are the primary source of animal protein. And they're the cheapest. They're still, despite the cost of getting these fish transported all the way out to these villages in the middle of nowhere, they're still the cheapest source of animal protein around.
Prechers says this source of protein and economic livelihood is disappearing because of overfishing. He says people all over West Africa are now hunting in game reserves to get protein from meat. His work shows that hunting has been hard on herds of wild animals that include elephants, lions, and leopards. Prechers published his findings last November in the journal Science. He says these problems occur around the world, and we need to find new ways to give people cheap protein that doesn't come from fish or other animals in the wild. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
And welcome back. Trillions for tax cuts for the rich. Trillions for privatizing Social Security. Job training cut by $500 million. Police and firefighters budgets slashed. Drug copayments for veterans doubled. That is the copayments, the part that the veterans have to pay. Big cuts in bioterrorism protection, leaving the poor out in the cold. Headlines from the Progress Report today, the American Progress Action Fund, AmericanProgress.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The Bush budget. Interesting news. Unfortunate news today. Bill in New Jersey's on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Bill?
You used to be on New York News 20 years ago or so.
No,
Tom Hartman in the New York area, and
No, I did radio in Michigan 25 years ago for about a decade.
I remember that name, but I wasn't interested in news then. I just associated the name. I thought maybe he's changed. I don't know.
No. Sorry.
Another quick question: The Last Hour's Ancient Sunlight, is that a book you've written?
Yeah, it's a book I wrote back in 97 that just we just updated, and Random House published it, and it's in all bookstores and libraries. And
what is it about?
Ancient Sunlight is oil, and it's about the end of the era of oil and how our society got to where we are and what we have to do to get, you know, through the fact that we've used up about half the world's oil and it's getting more and more expensive, and here in the United States we have nowhere near enough to meet our own needs, and so we're having to reach across the world to get it, and it's about peak oil.
I heard you about half an hour ago say something about, by the way, I think you have a good show. I'm getting you over the internet.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Where are we headed? What's going on?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Bill Cooper?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then
in
you
fact,
know
I've
what?
Heard him, I've heard him speak.
Behold a Pale Horse.
Yeah,
book.
He's dead now, but I heard him speak back when he was still around, and I think he's pushing the boundaries a little
bit. Right, I figured
some of the things he says
are interesting. And
they definitely are.
You connect some dots.
Yep, I agree. Bill, I got to move along. Thanks for the call, and I appreciate your saying it. Marvin in Austin, Texas on the line. Hey, Marvin, we got about a half a minute left here. What's up?
Okay, I'll just keep it real short then. If we ignore everything but the bottom line on the budget, and if George Bush delivers what he promises, to cut the budget in half, And like I said, this is ignoring all everything he's done otherwise. But budget-wise, if he does that, then he will manage to, then he'll be able to claim that he's half the president Bill Clinton was.
Yeah, what he's going to do is destroy the Republican Party. That's what he's going to do. Marvin, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's Tom Hartman here with you. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
United Airlines flight attendants and pilots accepted new contracts on Monday, while the Mechanics Union rejected their offer this weekend. In an effort to emerge from bankruptcy, the airline has been reducing wages and benefits across the board. The mechanics overwhelmingly voted down the contract offer, and more than 85% voted to authorize strike action. Richard Turk is the communications director for the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association.
Basically, the strike part of it's not going to come into play unless the judge abrogates our contract. If he abrogates our contract, we feel we have the right to strike. You can't change someone's contract and expect them to continue to work under it without having the right to self-help.
Turk says that each member has their own reason for rejecting the contract because not a single item in it wasn't concessionary.
I think the overriding issue is that most of the membership feels like enough is enough. We've taken pay cuts and we've done everything we can to help sustain United Airlines. We're willing to make United a better company. But until they change the way they do business, nothing's going to happen. They're not going to make money, even when they continue to take big cuts from us and subsidize fares with it.
The pilots agreed to an 11.8% pay cut, and the flight attendants will have their wages reduced by 9.5%. As for the mechanics, Turk says that the ball is now in the airline's court.
Montana has joined a list of red states where state employees face problems from Republicans over collective bargaining. Republicans in Montana's State House are holding up approval of a collective bargaining agreement reached between the Montana Public Employees Association and Governor Brian Schweitzer. Schweitzer is a newly elected Democratic governor. Tom Schneider, executive director of the Montana Public Employees Association, says state employees face a political stalemate forced by Republicans in Montana who control half of the State House.
Now we have a stalemated situation where at the present time we don't have a pay bill per se before the legislature because the Republicans refuse to back off of their proposal and the Democrats are sticking with what was negotiated with the governor.
Democrats control the state Senate in Montana and there's a Democratic governor as well, but the state House must also sign off on the pay raise for state workers. Schneider says state workers in Montana have the right to strike, and it would be a shame if that had to happen to enforce an agreement that the governor has already approved. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. America's harvest of shame continues when it comes to working and living conditions for farm workers. Oxfam says nearly 2 million farm workers, mostly immigrants, work like machines in the fields for poverty wages. Half of all farm worker families earn less than $10,000 a year. A tomato farm worker must pick nearly 2 tons of tomatoes to earn $50. Farm workers in the U.S. today are effectively earning 30% less than they were in 1980.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
In the depths of the Great Depression, not a single public library in America closed its doors. Banks went under, farmers went bankrupt, millions of people were out of work and out of luck, but the American public clung to its libraries, not only because of their inherent value to our society, but also because they are symbols of community strength and hope. How lame, then, to see public officials today, from George W. Bush to city council members, reaching for the budget axe to whack library funding, forcing branches to close, valuable services to be eliminated, and hours to be cut. In a time when governments dump billions of taxpayer dollars into corporate subsidies and boondoggles, our so-called leaders are failing the people by going after these true public treasures. Check out Salinas, California, a hard-hit working-class city which is now the largest population in America without a public library. Ironically, this is the hometown of John Steinbeck, the prize-winning author of The Grapes of Wrath and other powerful works that chronicle the human spirit during the Depression years. Steinbeck knew that literature has the power to elevate the spirit and help people rise above difficult times, and it's said that he got some of his early exposure to the power of literature at the Salinas Library. Since Steinbeck's day, Salinas expanded to 3 branch libraries, one named after him. But now, all 3 have been closed by the city council, which is facing large budget deficits. This move shuts out the 1,900 people a day who count on the library for books, literacy courses, internet access, after-school programs, and other services. Also, nearly 3 dozen employees have been shown the door. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is not a Salinas story, but a failure of all public leadership. Why are they dumping billions into Bush's Star Wars boondoggle, for example, while public libraries, which provide essential services that keep America informed and enlightened, are forced to go begging?
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Winter Brain Conference and StoryCon in Palm Springs, California. Rama Schneider back in the People's Republic of Vermont, keeping the show and the board together, and Ira Gravatt managing the telephones and other technical aspects of things. We will be back in Vermont tomorrow, broadcasting live, assuming that I make all my flights. If you hear a repeated show tomorrow, you'll know we got bumped. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Is it possible? We're talking here, and we started out the last hour, we were talking about the Bush budget cuts, and we didn't even really have an opportunity to get through half of what they're up to. I mean, there's just the agenda of these people is somewhere between callous and insane. And now we're finding that it even goes beyond that. It's these budget, of course, the budget cuts are all about,
Well, let's say more tax cuts for the rich and poor people. There's poor people. Education. We don't need no stinking education. And on it goes, you know.
Even veterans. That's got a lot of Republicans scared, cutting back on veterans benefits. But now, as I started in the last hour, now you see that this is really part of a larger, shall we call it an issue? Worldview, philosophy, not quite sure what the right word would be, but it's part of something larger, which has to do with the worldview and philosophy of these folks, which is that, caveat emptor, written large, let the buyer beware. You're on your own, buddy. Government plays no legitimate role, the cons say, in protecting we the people. If you're not smart enough or rich enough to hire people to protect you or figure things out for yourself, if you can't walk into a supermarket and with your X-ray goggles immediately discern that the food has bacterial contamination or not, tough luck. It's not the role of government to protect people, the conservatives tell us. Other than our national borders, then we want to pump as much money as we can into the Carlyle Group and the defense industry. So what about our food? Is our food becoming safer or less safe? Is it becoming perhaps even radioactive? Radioactive. Patricia Lavera, Patty Lavera, in January of 2001, joined CMEEP, that's the Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program, and is the deputy director. Previously, she worked for the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice as a researcher and editor. Patty, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
I'm very pleased to have you on. The news release I have here comes from Public Citizen. Are you working with Public Citizen?
Yeah, we have the Energy and Environment Program at Public Citizen.
Oh, okay. So this is a subset of Public Citizen.
Yes.
Great. I didn't catch that off the bio, and I was trying to figure that out. And the headline on this thing, this is interesting, and the information within it, rule to permit higher doses of food irradiation is flawed, Public Citizen says. Now, just a little background for our listeners, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of our food now is being cleaned of bacteria. The bacteria, any kind of contamination, bacterial or viral, presumably bacterial contamination that's in it or on it, is being nuked with radiation, primarily X-rays, although there are other forms of radiation as well that are used. And, of course, heat is a form of radiation as well. Cooking food is the traditional way that we irradiated food. And this has been a controversial thing for some time about, you know, what kinds of changes does it produce in food and how should it be done and all that. And now the government has decided that they're going to crank up the amount of radiation that can be used so that they can do bigger batches of food.
Exactly. So lots of foods are legal for irradiation and have been starting in the early 80s. And what happened just before Christmas, and the comment period just closed on this, was that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, said that companies using X-rays to irradiate food can increase the amount of energy by 50%. And so what happened in that change when you go, the rule used to be that the top level was 5 million electron volts is the unit, and they increased it to 7.5, and that is in the range where some studies have shown that components of the food could become radioactive.
Now, I found that particularly interesting. I have some passing familiarity with X-rays. I mean, you know, both medically and from having studied physics, and I didn't know that other than the ability of an X-ray to transfer energy to some particular elements and cause them to become ionized, that it was possible for X-radiation to have a lingering radioactive effect. How does that work?
Well, what they're doing is using X-rays to create ionizing radiation, and the machinery that does that involves bouncing the X-ray off some kind of metal to get the effect they're looking for, which is ionizing radiation, and that's what kills the bacteria.
It's not just X-rays. It's producing X-rays. Gamma rays.
Right. So it's X-rays used to create another type of energy.
Okay. And some of those secondary types of radiation are actually particles, not rays, and so they may embed themselves in the food and hang around for a while. Is that the point of it? to
right.
super simplify
and that's
it.
What we're calling for more study of, what else is happening to the food when you do this treatment to kill bacteria.
Yeah. And the other interesting and kind of semi-convenient thing about this from the industry's point of view is that while it renders food sterile, that is, it kills off the bacteria or any viruses or whatever phages that may be in it, it doesn't clean it. It doesn't remove poisons. It doesn't remove toxins. It doesn't remove dirt or filth or fecal matter or anything like that. But it raises it up to certain standards. This is sort of a on-the-cheap way of making sure that the food supply is, quote, safe, end quote.
Right, especially when you're talking about meat, when you're talking about something like E. coli, for example.
Yeah.
E. coli gets there by being carried in manure. I mean, that's just kind of the truth of the matter. It's
right,
gross,
it grows in the gut. Yeah.
Right. So
it has to come
what
from
you're
the
doing
gut.
When you irradiate is basically disinfecting what's there. You're not cleaning it off or removing it, and you're definitely not preventing it from getting it contaminated in the first place. And that's kind of our philosophical objection to relying on irradiation in the meat sector, especially, is because it gives them an excuse not to worry what happens before that point, because they know they're going to irradiate it at the end of the line.
No, traditionally what we did was we washed it off and we cleaned it up, and if an antiseptic of some sort was necessary, we would use that. But mostly you just wipe off the fecal matter, and now they're saying, well, it's no big deal. We're just going to kill the bacteria, and you know, a little fecal matter won't hurt you, apparently, is the philosophy of the FDA.
Right. And then
as long as it's profitable.
And, in the meat sector, it has a lot to do with the changing, you see, for government meat inspectors, and we've seen their authority really be diminished. So, and then at the same time, we see promotion of technologies like irradiation.
Yeah, in fact, we're seeing now cuts in the FDA's budget, as you know, George Bush's new budget, huge cuts in the EPA budget. But this isn't FDA, this is USDA, isn't it?
FDA allows the type of irradiation machine, and USDA oversees how it's used in a meat plant.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture, right.
So just this morning, actually, we're looking at the budget, and we're seeing that USDA's budget, there's a proposal from the Bush administration to allow the industry to pay for meat inspection that happens on the second or third shift. So the government takes
let's
first
put
day
the
hour.
Foxes in charge of the hen house again.
Exactly. So it's called user fees, but it's basically the industry paying for the regulators that are supposed to be overseeing them.
Yeah. It worked well over at FDA. It brought us Vioxx.
I mean, exactly. USDA has been a little bit different, and meat is a little bit different because we have government inspectors in there acting in the interest of consumers as an independent, you know, enforcement arm, and that's unique in the government, and now we see that being chipped away.
Yeah. Now taking this to the next step up, this news release that I have from Public Citizen talks about how numerous health problems have been observed in lab animals fed irradiated foods, including premature deaths, stillbirths, mutations, tumors, organ damage, and stunted growth, and that chemicals, including the you want to pronounce this one?
Alkylcyclobutanones.
Thank you. Alkylcyclobutanones have been linked up to colon cancer in rats and genetic damage in human cells. Are these chemicals and are these spin-offs, these byproducts of radiation, of exposing presumably organic compounds, carbon-containing compounds to these forms of radiation? Is this unique to these types of radiation, or is this another way of getting back to the fact that cooked food contains more carcinogens than uncooked food, for example?
Well, that's a good question, and there are some chemicals that are byproducts of irradiation that you might find in cooked meat, for example. You know, like you do see benzene, and you see benzene when you grill meat. But then, for example, the alkylcyclobutanones fall under a category that are called unique radiolytic products, which means they only happen when you irradiate food. So one of the alkylcyclobutanones is actually used as a marker if you want to see if food has been irradiated. Because it's unique, you're not going to find it in any other food.
Oh, interesting. So you can determine how effective you were determine how effective you were at irradiating the stuff by seeing how much of the alkylcyclobutanones were produced. And these are chemicals that cause colon cancer and genetic damage in human cells and rats?
Well, the studies on alkylcyclobutanones haven't been done in the U.S., and that's a real bone of contention we have with the government. A lot of them have been done in the European Union, and researchers there saw an association between exposure to these chemicals and those kinds of changes, and they called for more studies to be done. And in fact, right, because of that kind of uncertainty about these chemicals, the European Parliament, which sets the rules for the whole European Union, a few years ago decided not to expand the list of foods that are eligible for irradiation there until these kinds of things are further investigated. Over here, we have the FDA and the USDA saying, oh, don't worry about it, we're going to approve more foods. And
well, that's because there's a major philosophical difference between the United States, mm-hmm, and Europe, and we only have about a minute left here, Patty. But here in the United States, we basically say, let's try it out, and if anybody dies, then we'll stop, whereas over in Europe, they employ the precautionary principle.
Exactly. And
you might,
one more example.
Yeah, in the little bit of time here left we have, why don't you just outline that very quickly and so our listeners are familiar with it.
Well, I mean, the idea of the precautionary principle is that you use the weight of the evidence, even if it's not entirely nailed down or proven, and if it seems like there's potential for harm, you take action then. And that's the precautionary principle, and it's basically better safe than sorry. And so it puts more distance and more time before you would approve something like irradiation. Whereas here, we basically have a philosophy of it's innocent until proven guilty. You know, and so
yeah,
we have much more controversial things like GMOs and irradiation approved before all the evidence is in about its safety.
Right. So they say better safe than sorry, and we say better profitable than safe.
Than slow or deliberate when you're considering whether to approve these things.
Yeah, so much of this is really just coming down to this ruling is designed to benefit industry, for example, is what Winona Howder of Public Citizen said. This is the bottom line here.
Mm-hmm.
Patty, thanks so much for being with us. Patty Lavera is the website, publiccitizen.org, is that it?
It's citizen.org.
Citizen.org. Citizen.org. Great. Thank you so much, Patty. I appreciate you being with us on the program today. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Love rules.
Our son gets mad. He tries to shout.
We'll take away his cell phone, his video game.
And if we have to, we'll take away his freedom.
He's got to understand that there will be consequences for breaking our rules.
It doesn't matter that he's not smoking. When we say not to hang out with the weed crowd,
we mean it.
That's what it takes to keep him away from marijuana.
And we love him enough to live with that.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana.
Paid for by ONDCP.
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartmann program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartmann.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Stay from the old, yes. Stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya. He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. Why, soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared.
And disappeared.
Never yet devil speak, yes, swift boats swindle come. No one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled them.
Yes,
and
they razzle-dazzled
gave you four them. More.
And they gave you four more.
Love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
I just love that bumper music. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. And Ellen, I'm guessing you've got lots of information about this new budget that we
Oh, used. Boy, do I. First of all, the president had a cabinet meeting this morning, and he said the budget reflected his priorities, defense, homeland security, and entitlements. Now, the defense.
And tax cuts for the rich.
Well, that's right. In fact, Ken Conrad said that the budget does not at all address the $1.6 trillion costs of the 10-year tax cuts. The Defense Department budget went up 4.8%. That's a total of 41% since 2001. Now, then he puts in some of his, quote-unquote, programs. There's $200 million for the purchase for down payments for low-income people, which would give a down payment to 40,000 people. Now, Tom, if you do the math, and I know you're pretty good at it, 1 week in Iraq is approximately $1 billion. Of course, that's not even addressed in this budget. But if we didn't go to Iraq for 1 week, instead of being able to purchase down payments for low-income people so they can buy their own homes, we'd be able to do that for 200,000 people, not just 40,000 people.
In 1 week?
In 1 week of Iraq spending. That's
wow.
Right.
Yeah. I love it when these numbers get framed in ways that people can understand, that they can get their hands around, that they can visualize, that they can understand the story of. Because so often it's just a billion here, a billion, and people don't know what it means. You know?
Well, let me give you another example. He put in $2 billion. That's an increase, actually, of $304 million for these rural health care centers. Now, you live in Vermont. You know how important that is.
Yeah.
And so if you take, again, $2 billion, which is the total amount for rural health care centers, that's 2 weeks in Iraq.
Wow.
So when you really begin to look at the budget in that way, I mean, this is a number that will send you to the moon. He's put in, he increased it by $46 million, $210 million to clean up brownfields. Now, if that isn't our homeland and our security, again, 210 million is one-fifth of a week in Iraq.
Yeah, it's basically a day and a half.
Right.
And another way to frame this, Ellen, which would be really interesting, would be to frame it in this is how many days of tax cuts for the rich, because the $200 billion a year cost of Iraq, or the 100 and it's working out to what?
It's basically a billion a week of actual costs in Iraq, but that's excluding the Defense Department budget.
Right, and it's also excluding a lot of the money that's going to Halliburton and the whole reconstruction thing. But my point was I'm guessing, and I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, so I can't do it. But this is something we should look at. I'm guessing that the tax cuts for the rich, on a week by week basis, are costing us just as much as Iraq is.
Well, you figure you've got 1.6 trillion over 10 years, right?
Right.
So it's one.
So that's $160 billion a year,
right?
That's $160 billion
a year. $160 billion a year.
Yeah, so it's actually twice as much.
That's
so
right.
So you could build all those. You could make all those down payments for poor people for not just $200,000 for a week of tax cuts for the rich, but for in 3 days. I mean, it's incredible.
Right.
Ellen, thanks for the info. Thanks for the insight. I so appreciate it. It's so great to hear from you, and the great job that you're doing there with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. We will talk with you tomorrow. Have a good one.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
United Airlines flight attendants and pilots accepted new contracts on Monday, while the Mechanics Union rejected their offer this weekend. In an effort to emerge from bankruptcy, the airline has been reducing wages and benefits across the board. The mechanics overwhelmingly voted down the contract offer, and more than 85% voted to authorize strike action. Richard Turk is the communications director for the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association.
Basically, the strike part of it's not going to come into play unless the judge abrogates our contract. If he abrogates our contract, we feel we have the right to strike. You can't change someone's contract and expect them to continue to work under it without having the right to self-help.
Turk says that each member has their own reason for rejecting the contract because not a single item in it wasn't concessionary.
I think the overriding issue is that most of the membership feels like enough is enough. We've taken pay cuts and we've done everything we can to help sustain United Airlines. We're willing to make United a better company. But until they change the way they do business, nothing's going to happen. They're not going to make money, even when they continue to take pay cuts from us and subsidize fares with it.
The pilots agreed to an 11.8% pay cut, and the flight attendants will have their wages reduced by 9.5%. As for the mechanics, Turk says that the ball is now in the airline's court.
Montana has joined a list of red states where state employees face problems from Republicans over collective bargaining. Republicans in Montana's state house are holding up approval of a collective bargaining agreement reached between the Montana Public Employees Association and Governor Brian Schweitzer. Schweitzer is a newly elected Democratic governor. Tom Schneider, executive director of the Montana Public Employees Association, says state employees face a political stalemate forced by Republicans in Montana who control half of the state house.
Now we have a stalemated situation where at the present time we don't have a pay bill per se before the legislature because the Republicans refuse to back off of their proposal, and the Democrats are sticking with what was negotiated with the governor.
Democrats control the state Senate in Montana, and there's a Democratic governor as well, but the state House must also sign off on the pay raise for state workers. Schneider says state workers in Montana have the right to strike, and it would be a shame if that had to happen to enforce an agreement that the governor has already approved. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. America's harvest of shame continues when it comes to working and living conditions for farm workers. Oxfam says nearly 2 million farm workers, mostly immigrants, work like machines in the fields for poverty wages. Half of all farm worker families earn less than $10,000 a year. A tomato farm worker must pick nearly 2 tons of tomatoes to earn $50. Farm workers in the U.S. today are effectively earning 30% less than they were in 1980.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, here we are in sunny California. It's actually a little overcast today here in Palm Springs. Beautiful day, beautiful sunny day yesterday. Palm Springs has to be the cosmetic surgery capital of the planet. We had to walk down to the Radio Shack store on Thursday when we arrived and pick up a little adapter plug that I forgot for the microphone stuff here, you know, all this technical stuff. And Louise and I are walking down the street, and there's this whole district. I mean, it must have been 5 city blocks of cosmetic dental surgery, cosmetic this, cosmetic that, cosmetic the other thing. Well, now West Hollywood. This is one of those only in America stories. West Hollywood is going to ban, or there will be a proposal put forward by City Council Mayor, by the City Council and Mayor John Duran, or Duran, is going to seek a ban on cosmetic surgery for pets. The cosmetic surgery craze in California has extended to pets. And it's getting out of control, and West Hollywood is going to ban it. This only in California. I got to tell you, just a little story around this kind of thing. About, I don't know, it must have been 10 years ago or so. I was speaking at a conference on my topics. It was actually a talk I was giving on my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, in fact, which was mentioned earlier. And the conference was one of these big conferences, you know, with 100 speakers that runs over a weekend and you know, different people in different rooms talking all at the same time and all this stuff. And when I wasn't speaking, we were sticking our heads in and hearing folks talk and different folks in different places. In fact, that was where we heard the speech by the fellow who was telling us that Bill Clinton was actually one of the lizard people who zipped on his human suit every day. But that's another story for another time. Anyhow, Louise and I went into this one room where there was a talk on aging. And I thought, well, this will be interesting because I'm starting to get into middle age anyway. And so we walked in, sat down, and there was this panel, 3 people. There was a cosmetic surgeon and a woman who was a trainer of some kind and some guy who was into health foods and antioxidants and whatnot. And for 15, 20 minutes or so, we heard them talking about all these ways to make yourself look younger. Whether it was surgery or whether it was cosmetics or, you know, is particular types of exercise and things. And it all had to do with looking younger. And I'm a little gray, and so I stood up. This was a conference in California, by the way. I stood up and I said, I was wondering if you could just address the issue of aging gracefully. Rather than, you know, going to battle with age, just aging gracefully. What's wrong with that? And there was this stunned silence. And then the plastic surgeon who was on the panel, finally, I mean, everybody was just like apparently shocked by this. It was as if I had made one of those unmentionable bodily noises. And he just somebody else had their hand up, and he just goes to the next person and says, well, what's your question, ma'am? And, you know, I sat back down, and so I never did get the answer to that question. So hopefully we're doing it. But 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartman.com, the website. Drop into our live chat room. Participate in the message board. We've got some questions from the message board we're going to get to here later on in the day. But first, let's go to the phone lines. Kate in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
My phone's beeping. I hope I can hang in there with it. Just wanted to get back to the thing about radiation in food and the government policy in Europe being to protect the people. So, I mean, the government responsibility is to protect the people.
The precautionary
policy
principle
is better safe than sorry.
Right.
For us, the Bush administration sees the government's responsibility to protect profit. Therefore, I think their policy, the ruling thought, is easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and that's a really good way of boiling it down, Kate. And that is the great divide in American politics right now that nobody is really talking about in our mass media.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because that triggered that what's a succinct way to put that. And I think that that prevailing mindset has always been at battle with the, protecting the people, better safe than sorry mindset. And I think that prevailing mindset of it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission has impact all over the place if you start looking at our culture and seeing that that mindset is operating in so many different areas.
Yeah, and there's a second part to that, and that I'm sure you're aware of, which is it's more profitable to seek forgiveness than to seek permission.
Absolutely.
Particularly if you can get laws passed called tort reform that say when you do seek forgiveness that you don't have to pay very much.
Yes.
That's really what's going on.
Yeah. I think it's an important thought to ponder. What kind of operating mindset that we're using or other people are using, and begin to come up with words and phrases and ways to counter that.
Yeah,
so
I
thank
heard
you.
That
was
before.
My little addition today.
Thank you, Kate. Great to hear from you. I appreciate your call. I had heard that phrase before. Better to ask forgiveness than for permission. And I need to make that a regular part of my lexicon, because it's a good one. It's a good one. Brilliant. Well said. And this is, as I said, this is the great divide that nobody's talking about. On the extreme right wing, you have folks who believe that corporations and the large multinational corporations, absolutely unrestrained corporate activity and the free market, as so-called free market, it's not free and it's not a market, but they call it that. It sounds nice. Will, over time, always solve all problems. And there is no example in history of this ever having been the case. In fact, when you look back in history, you find that the reverse is the case, as Charles Dickens so brilliantly illustrated in the vast majority of his novels. Dostoevsky, it goes on and on. Dickens was really eloquent, though, about the economic situation in Victorian England when you had unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism. Absolutely unrestrained, basically corporate or wealthy interests running the show, and everybody else was terrified and poor. And I think one of the reasons Dickens was so conscious of this was that his own father had been thrown into debtor's prison. And it wasn't like he was on a crusade. It was just like he understood. And so you have the Christmas Carol, where Bob Cratchit doesn't, his child, Tiny Tim, doesn't have health care, and he may die. And if he's not going to die, he's going to be deformed for the rest of his life. And he doesn't have enough food to feed his family. He certainly doesn't have enough for the Christmas dinner. And he has to put up with an abusive employer who demands that he work long hours under cold conditions, where he, unhealthy conditions. Only one lump of coal today, Mr. Cratchit. Only one lump of coal has to keep you warm all day. Oh, please, sir, I'd like, my fingers are too cold. I can't write the numbers in the ledger for you. Only one lump of coal. Yes. This is the world that the conservatives want to take us back to. The Republican Party, the conservative movement, the party of the past. The party of old ideas, the old ideas of feudalism. Grover Norquist being one of their perhaps most eloquent spokesmen. 1-866-889-8894, Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. what Kate was saying as far as the easier to ask for forgiveness than permission was actually originally designed for activists to get around corporate bureaucracies, for the entrepreneurs to take control and to do right things and make changes in an unresponsive bureaucracy.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a history to this that you know of that I'm not familiar with.
Give me an example. Oh, I don't know, at least 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And it was basically, if you're stymied in a big corporation, how do you go around it? Hey, if you got the nerve and you got your act together, go ahead and do it. If you violated policy and it all works out fine, and it was based on going into it with good intentions, that you were wanting to make things happen.
Oh, so this is a slogan that evolved out of the cubicle culture, basically, out of people who work in large corporate bureaucracies.
Right. I'll try to get some stuff and zap it off to you. It's kind of laying in the back, and that wasn't the reason that I called, but it has been completely distorted back to the ends meet justifies the means, or means justifies the ends.
The ends justify the means.
The reason that I called was knowing that you were going to be at the Story Conference. I was watching CNN, a week or so ago, and I just wanted to cry. They had some Marines and troopers who had been blown up and, you know, suffered limb damage and everything else. And it was amazing the way that CNN was positioning the whole thing, that these were such brave troopers defending our freedom over there in Iraq. And then they had the clips of the guys. Gee, it's better we were fighting them over there than over here. And the one guy that just, I wanted to scratch my head and scream, he lost a leg, and it was like the worst thing that ever happened. But God is going to give me the strength to get through this. And, of course, my first question was, well, if God's going to give you the strength to get through it, why did he throw that thing out there in the first place?
Well, you know, I'm not going to go there, Roy. I believe that if this guy believes that God's going to give him the strength to get through it, God is going to give him the strength to get through it.
That will be his tool.
But yeah, absolutely. But the tragedy.
The whole thing that we are fighting for freedom, our freedom over there.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got
a lot of these kids who have been watching Fox News and they've been listening to George W. Bush, and they are among that 70% of Bush voters who believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 when he, in fact, had absolutely nothing to do with it whatsoever. In fact, that classic photo of the tanks in the Kuwaiti desert preparing to drive into Iraq, where on the side of one of the tanks with a spray paint, one of the guys had written 9/11 payback time. And this is what the soldiers, many of the soldiers, believed they were all about when they went into Iraq. And many of them still believe it. And on the other hand, you also have a lot of soldiers who are just really engaging in a very understandable and relatively straightforward psychological defense mechanism. If you had lost something as valuable to you as a leg or an arm or an eye,
you have to justify it.
You have to assign some meaning to it. And the real tragedy, you know, when I see these soldiers who say, we have to be over there and fight them over there, otherwise we'll have to fight them here, when, of course, the Iraqis have no desire to come here whatsoever, never have, you know, it's not, other than the Iraqi entrepreneurs who are coming here.
Right.
But and there's many of them. They were voting in the election. But when I hear them say that, part of me actually says, well, you know, that's actually, it's an okay thing. I don't mind if they say that. I have a problem when our commander-in-chief says that, knowing that it's a lie. I don't have a problem if a kid, right? I don't have a problem if a kid with his leg blown off is reciting that mantra as that's what's going to get him through. That his sacrifice was a noble sacrifice. In fact, I think that that's probably kind of a good thing. But it'll
motivate him. And you know, my nephew went back for his buddies, not for his country. He went back to do his job and protect his friends.
Yeah. But I have to say the ones that really sadden me, Roy, are the ones that you almost never see on TV, which are the soldiers who lost a leg or an arm or are paralyzed or whatever, and who know the truth, who know that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that the CIA by and large knew that before we went in, that the people within the Department of Energy knew that, that all of Europe knew that, that Hans Blix was telling us that, that Mohammed al-Baradei was telling us that. These are mostly members of the National Guard who were not in the military and not subject to the military indoctrination, you know, the very limited news exposure that they got, but instead, you know, got dragged in once the war started. And they have paid this terrible price, and they know that it was just so that George W. Bush could make himself a war president and get himself reelected in 2004. And because Paul Wolfowitz had this bizarre idea that if we put this big footprint in the middle of the Middle East, we could A, lock up the oil, and B, make Israel more secure. And, of course, we're not doing either. I mean, those are both laudable goals, I suppose, but this was the most stupid way to accomplish them. As Brent Scowcroft would be the first to tell you.
Ones of the ones that were killed.
Yeah, and so those...
That were fighting it, but yet had to support them in doing what they needed to do as they saw their duty. It is just...
Yeah.
But
those are the ones that sadden me the most.
We just have to keep fighting the myth.
Yeah. Yeah, but those with regard to the soldiers, I mean that's the really tough one. And Roy, I appreciate your call. Those are the soldiers that, in my mind, are the really tragic figures. The ones who get it, that their sacrifice for their buddies, for their country, you know, with the very best of intentions, doing the right thing, joining the military, and doing what their commander in chief told them, and then learning that their commander in chief had lied to them. Had stovepiped information, and they lost a leg as a result of it, or they lost it. Those just make me so sad. John in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, man, you are so patronizing. You're talking about these soldiers that are deluding themselves over there by saying, well, I did it for a good cause, but you know, jeez.
John,
they should just be stupid and... But it's still a good thing if they're just stupid and doing it for stupid reasons, right, Tom? You're so patronizing. I can't believe it. And
thanks a lot, John.
So
I appreciate
wrong.
Your call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's Tom Hartman here with you. John, I'm not patronizing these people. I am pointing out the very simple reality that you have people with two different understandings of what this war is about and two different ways of coping with it. We'll be right back.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews.
What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
America's attitude toward nuclear power is worlds away from that of some other countries. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Switzerland and Japan generate nearly 40% of their electricity from nuclear reactors. And last year, China announced plans to build 30 nuclear power plants in coming years. By comparison, the United States has virtually halted nuclear construction, relying on the technology for only 20% of its electricity. Michael Corradini is a nuclear engineer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says many countries have turned toward nuclear energy because they have fewer resources than the United States does.
The international scene very much depends on that country's ability to get energy indigenous to its borders.
Corradini says Japan is an example. It has no energy resources such as coal or oil. Corradini says nuclear power also gives heavily populated developing countries a way to improve.
The most interesting thing are the developing nations, where they're trying to move up in economic status and standard of living. China's an example, Korea an example. And in all those cases, you see that nuclear power is really considered to be one, not the only, but one of the ways to do it.
Corradini contends that more nuclear power would help the U.S. cut its reliance on coal and natural gas, but the failure to effectively deal with nuclear waste is the main factor weighing against the technology.
If we continue to simply store it and not deal with it, it is not really addressing the thing that many people worry about, which is if you produce waste in the form of spent fuel, are you starting to do something with it?
Japan, France, and other countries reprocess nuclear waste as a way to reduce it. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those mads in Tiananmen Square.
So here we have now a commentary by David Kay, the official former CIA operative handpicked by the Bush administration to determine whether the young men and women in Iraq who have lost arms and legs did so because there really were weapons of mass destruction there, as Bush and Cheney lied to us about, or whether their efforts were the result of something genuine. David Kay in today's Washington Post. 1 year ago, he says, I told the Senate Armed Services Committee that I had concluded we were almost all wrong at the time of the Iraq War about that country's activities with regard to weapons of mass destruction, and never more wrong than in the assessment that Iraq had a resurgent program on the verge of producing nuclear weapons. He says, I testified about what I saw as the major reasons we got it so wrong. By the way, that was the fact that Rummy had set up his own little stove-piping intelligence agency so that they could cherry-pick what they wanted. They were listening to Chalabi. They were basically ignoring all the evidence. The rest of the world is looking at this. Hans Blix is running around there. Mohammed al-Baradei is running around there. Yeah, France, Germany, Russia, China, all these other countries are going, you know, we're looking at the evidence. We don't see anything there. George Bush is going, I really don't think that Bush thought we were going to lose 1,000 soldiers. Give him that small amount of credit. But here they are. Anyhow, David Kay in today's Washington Post saying, please don't make this mistake again. He goes on to say, I testified about what I saw as the major reasons we got it so wrong, and I urged the establishment of an independent commission to examine this failure and begin the long overdue process. Okay, so they put this together and they looked into it. He says, a year later, we are still awaiting the independent commission's report. Yeah, and David, I can tell you, we're probably never going to see it. And then he goes on to say, there's an eerie similarity to the events preceding the Iraq war now with regard to Iran. He says, and now we hear the drum rolls again. Keep in mind, this is a Republican employee of George W. Bush. And now we hear the drum rolls again, this time announcing an accelerating nuclear weapons program in Iran. There is an eerie similarity to the events preceding the Iraq war. And he says, the International Atomic Energy Agency has announced that while Iran now admits to having concealed for 18 years a program, it has found no evidence of a nuclear weapons program. Iran is now fully cooperating with international inspections. And yet Cheney is giving interviews and speeches that paint a stark picture of a soon-to-be nuclear-armed Iran. In other words, the lies are beginning all over again. And here we have David Kaye in the Washington Post. No, I'm sorry, it's not patronizing to point this out. It's truth-telling. Incredible. Tom Hartman, here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
The AFL-CIO has chosen not to endorse anyone in a race that some say will determine the future of the Democratic Party. Upon hearing the news, former Texas Congressman Martin Frost, who is depending on an endorsement from the Labor Federation, announced his intent to drop out of the race for chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Union officials say Frost didn't show enough movement to win labor support. The departure of Frost narrows the field to former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, New Democrat Network President Simon Rosenberg, former Indiana Representative Tim Romer, and political consultant Donnie Fowler. Gerald McEntee, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, told the Associated Press that at the AFL-CIO political meeting, some were for Frost and some were for Dean, but the committee decided that it would be best to let individual unions decide for themselves. Many see Frost dropping out as a boost for Fowler, who has tried to position himself as the anti-Dean. While the AFL-CIO has chosen not to endorse anyone, individual unions have begun announcing support for candidates. Just this week, the United Auto Workers and the United Steelworkers of America gave their nods to Howard Dean. The vote will be held in Washington, D.C. on February 12th.
As President Bush brings his Social Security privatization pitch to Midwest states today, including North and South Dakota and Nebraska, the AFL-CIO is joining other progressive groups to rally against it. AFL-CIO Midwest Representative Shelley Zeeberg says that draining money from Social Security into private accounts undermines Social Security while creating as much as $2 trillion in more federal debt. Seberg says not only does Bush's irresponsible scheme not strengthen Social Security, but it undermines it.
Well, the truth of the matter is, under the Bush plan, Social Security would run out of money 14 years sooner than is now expected. And so essentially, this makes Social Security funding problems even worse, not better.
France may soon see an end to its 35-hour work week. While a recent poll shows the majority of French workers don't want to work more, the parliament has begun a three-day debate on the issue. They are debating a bill that would allow workers to clock more than 35 hours a week in return for more pay. The government issued a statement that says a longer work week is important to keep the country's economy stimulated.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. This year, according to Deloitte and Touche, the top 100 global financial services firms will offshore more than $200 billion of their operating costs. TechWeb says offshoring in information tech industries is expected to grow nearly 20% each year through 2008, with the average company sending 60% of its computer application work to low-wage nations by 2009. According to a University of California, Berkeley study, 14 million Americans hold jobs at risk of being outsourced. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International Peace for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org. Or call 215-567-110.
Credit card companies love you. Giants like Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and MBNA constantly fill our mailboxes with little love letters, wooing us to accept their cards. But, like so many love affairs, once you've signed up, the companies suddenly show an ugly, grasping, selfish side of their personality. What you learn is that credit firms seem to enjoy penalizing their customers. For example, I recently paid a monthly bill of about $1,000 on an MBNA card, but I accidentally wrote a check that was $10 short. The next month, MBNA hit me for an interest finance charge of $21. That's an interest of more than 200% on a $10 debt. Oh, they calmly explained when I called, we don't just assess the penalty on the amount you were short, but on the entire $1,000 that you owed for the month, even though you already had paid $990 of it. Check the fine print of your agreement, they said, lovingly. Perhaps you, like me, try to pay your balance in full each month to avoid such usurious interest rates. But now, they've invented a most unloving trick. Most of us assume that our bills are not due until 30 days after we get them in the mail. The banks, however, have oh so quietly shrunk this common grace period to 20 days or less. Also, Citibank and MBNA are among those that now include sneaky fine print specifying an hour that your payment is due. Say, 1 p.m. on the 20th, $39, plus penalty interest rates as high as 30%, even though you think you paid your bill on time and in full. This is Jim Hightower saying, they stiffed last year. To fight back, call U.S. PIRG, 212-546-9707.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, in 29 states on cable systems, cable radio network. Welcome back to our program, the third hour of our program. Are we at the edge of an environmental apocalypse? And a particularly appropriate question on this day when the Bush administration is putting forward a budget which will cut back on EPA activity, no activity that I've been able to see with regard to Kyoto, the reduction of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, pushing for, if Bush is now reintroducing his so-called Clear Sky initiatives, which it actually would roll back, diminish the protections that we have to some extent, bragging about it, calling it a good thing. Into this fray steps a fellow who was on our program 2 years ago and one of my absolute favorite authors. I quoted his work in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I think he's one of the most brilliant people writing on this topic right now. His first book, The Heat Is On, was one of the seminal turning point books in the field. His new book is Boiling Point. Ross Gelbspan. Ross, welcome to the program.
Tom, hi. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm so pleased to have you. Ross's website, by the way, for our listeners, is heatisonline.org. Heat is online. A nice little sort of a pun there, I suppose. Ross, are we really facing an apocalypse, as this headline in the British paper The Independent asserted yesterday?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Tom, we are. Because that headline is based on some very recent findings that basically say we have about a 10-year window to cut our use of coal and oil by about 70%, and if not, we will see major, major disruptions beginning to kick in, you know, within the next couple of decades after that. So clearly the world can't turn on a dime if you think about changing all the world's energy systems in a really short time. That's a huge task. But that is what nature is telling us. And if we don't do that, we're going to see all kinds of very dire consequences. Just real briefly, temperature's risen in the past century or so by about 1 degree. And just from that, the deep oceans are heating, the tundra's thawing, the glaciers are melting, ice shelves are breaking off Antarctica, violent weather's increasing, and fish, birds, insects, animals, and whole ecosystems all over the pole, all over the world are migrating toward the poles in search of temperature stability. That's from 1 degree. If we don't make these cuts very soon,
when you say that's from 1 degree, what, you know, for our listeners, what you're saying is that we have seen in the last roughly 50 years about a 1 degree Celsius increase in worldwide temperatures, and all of this is the result of that 1 degree change. Is that correct?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. And there's more to come because there's a lag time.
If we don't make these radical changes.
Yeah. Okay. And so, pardon me, I interrupted you in midstream there. You said that's from that. What we're seeing so far is from that 1 degree. Now we are poised for what?
For real climate chaos if we don't make those changes, you know. There will be all kinds of consequences. You can see it just from some of the weather that we're looking at, and that's sort of the most visible and superficial manifestation. But if you remember in a summer and a half ago, there were 30,000 people in Europe who were killed by this heat wave they had. Southern Australia is now in the third year of a permanent drought that has, you know, totally decimated its crops. There was a storm last May that dumped 5 feet of rain in 36 hours on southern Haiti. We had these four hurricanes in Florida that were strengthened by warming surface waters. Last summer's monsoons left 30 million people homeless in South Asia. And this year, of course, began with these record rainfall and mudslides in California. And I'm looking out the window here on the remnants of 2.5 feet of snow we got in Boston over one day a couple of weeks ago. So it will be very grim if we don't mend our ways very quickly.
Yeah, the movie, there was this movie, The Day After Tomorrow, and the premise of the movie, of course, they had dramatized everything. They had taken an event that will probably take a year or two or three, it's escaping me now. Anyhow, that will probably take a few years for the Atlantic to release all of its heat energy into the atmosphere once the Gulf Stream shuts down. They condensed that down to a few days and took a little poetic license with it. But nonetheless, this was what they were describing in that book, in that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, was the shutting down of the Great Conveyor Belt, the Gulf Stream, mm-hmm. was something that 5 years ago nobody was even talking about. Nobody was even seriously, I think, thinking about. And now we discover a year ago, 2 years ago, the Pentagon actually did a study on how, if this were to happen, would it change the global balance of power, you know, the fact that all of a sudden 800 million people in Europe would have would be unable to produce food, and Europe would be glaciated, reglaciated, and on and on. You know, what's this going to mean for the Pentagon's mission? And this really has the folks in Europe alarmed. And I'd like you to speak to that. And the other question that I wanted to just toss out here, if I can give you a twofer. I was in Australia 4 years ago doing a speaking tour for one of my books. It was being published by Bantam Doubleday Dell there in Australia. And so we were in Sydney and Brisbane and Melbourne and up in Cairns. And they were having – this was the first year that they had the really bad fires. And the fires were coming right up against Sydney. And – I turned on the evening news, and here's ABC News. This is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, nationwide network news. And the weatherman says, and I mean, this is pretty close to a verbatim quote, you know, from memory, but nonetheless, the weatherman standing in front of the map, just like, you know, in America, and he says, as a result of global warming and global climate change, we can expect this region of Australia to be much more vulnerable to fires over the next few decades. We're seeing the beginnings of this right now. Whereas over here in this part of Australia, we may have some problems with floods and typhoons. We may have storms over here that we haven't seen before. And I mean, just absolutely matter of fact. I saw the same thing year before last. I was invited to speak at Oxford University. I was in London, and it was that week in November where they had 60 mile an hour winds. We flew mm-hmm. into Heathrow in this thing. They had not seen winds like this in record, as far as I can recall. And again, the weathermen were going on TV and saying, as a result of global climate change, we are seeing this weather. We never in the United States hear our news reporters talk in those terms. Why?
You are absolutely right. And one of the chapters in this book, Boiling Point, is devoted to the press, because I really do regard the press in the U.S. as very, very culpable for this stuff. There is no reason that this is off the public's radar screen. And the press has done a really, really bad job on this. Let me go back to the first part of your questioning. I'm sorry?
Haven't they been cowed? I mean, isn't it every time some reporter sticks their head up to talk about global warming, you got Fred Singer and a half a dozen corporate-funded pseudo think tanks hop out and say, it's a liberal media. There's a real debate about this. There's six scientists who say this is nonsense versus 3,000 who say it's going to happen, but that's really a debate. Pardon
You're
me.
Absolutely right. See, what these PR people from Big Coal and Big Oil have done is they've totally exploited the ethic of journalistic balance in a very bad way. And so that's exactly what they do. They want equal time, and too many reporters fall for this. And when a story is an issue of opinion, you know, should gay marriage be legalized, you know, should we have a war in Iraq, then when it's an opinion story, a reporter is ethically obligated to give every side their competing point of view. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt, find out what the facts are, and report it. And in this area, what we know about the climate comes from more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. Nevertheless, they continue to quote these skeptics. The one who bothers me the most is Singer, because Singer has lied about his funding. Singer declared in the Washington Post a couple of years ago he hadn't gotten any oil industry money for 20 years since he did some consulting gig, whereupon we published an article in The Nation saying, wait a second, he got $75,000 from ExxonMobil in 1998. It happened to be on their website. Of course, as soon as the article ran, they took it off their website. But the press still goes to this guy.
He goes to the press. But the other problem,
well, he goes,
Ross,
to the press.
Is,
that's right.
The other problem, Ross Gelbspan, who is, and I just want to repeat it again, heatisonline.org, your website, your new book, The Boiling Point, which I want our listeners to run out and buy right as soon as they finish listening to this program today. The other problem is that you have a media system in the United States, a very large corporate media bureaucracy that requires access to politicians and particularly to the White House in order to be able to do its job. in order to be able to convey the news. And the White House is saying to these reporters, if you talk, essentially, implicitly saying, they're not explicitly, but the message is out there very clearly. Look at what they did to Helen Thomas. If you talk about these issues in a way that displeases us, we will cut off your access. So it's not just the corporate shills out there. I mean, we have actually the government of the United, or not the government of the United States, but the administration that is in the White House and in Congress, making the situation even worse, aren't they?
Absolutely. And in particular in this area, it's very interesting that in this area, the climate and energy policies of the Bush administration are being dictated by ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal and other large oil and coal companies. So
yeah.
In this particular area, they're especially misleading and defensive and closed-mouthed about this issue. I want to go back to the first part of your question when you were talking
sure.
about how serious things are in Europe and even that Pentagon report, because it puts what this administration and its corporate supporters, especially its energy industry supporters, are doing. I mean, the science, Tom, the science says very clearly we got to cut emissions globally by 70%. As a result of that, Holland has just finished a plan to cut her emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed Britain to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to cuts of 50% in 50 years. So it's very clear that the rest of the world is taking this very seriously.
But we're not.
The Pentagon report was particularly important because I think what it did was reposition climate change not as an environmental issue but as a security issue, and that's really where it belongs. It is way bigger than the way we think traditionally of environmental issues. And yet again, the Bush administration, of course, has also turned its back on that Pentagon report.
Well, we have a president who's an oil industry CEO. We have a vice president who's an oil industry CEO. We have a secretary of state who has a tanker named after her. I mean, here we are. We have about 30 seconds left, Ross.
Okay.
Besides buying your book, Boiling Point, and visiting your website, heatisonline.org, Ross Gelbspan, what can the average person do? What should people do today?
I think people should really bug their news outlets to tell them the truth about global warming and keep this story in the papers and in the news broadcasts 3-4 times a week. This is very important.
Be the squeaky wheel.
I'm sorry?
Be the squeaky wheel.
Absolutely. It's also really important that a lot of good people sort of respond to these things with lifestyle changes, and you cannot solve this problem by lifestyle changes, even if we all sat in the dark and rode.
No, we have to change the ship of government, and we have to contact our elected officials. Ross Gelbspan, his new book, The Boiling Point. Ross, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for giving the subject to the airtime.
I guess
Tom,
I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews.
What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is getting so much press all around the world, and here in the United States, the corporate media is literally terrified to report about it for fear that they will be slapped down by the Bush administration, which doesn't want to talk about it, because they are taking so much money from the oil and coal and extractive industries. These huge corporate behemoths that brought Ronald Reagan to power in the 1980s. Thus, he ended all of Carter's subsidies to jumpstart the alternative energy movement in the United States. Tax breaks for energy efficient homes, the tax breaks for businesses that saved energy, grants for developing solar and wind power and geothermal power. In fact, Reagan's first official act of office was to remove the solar collectors from the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter had put there. Remember Jimmy Carter talking about, let's wear sweaters, turn the thermostat down a little bit in the winter? Well, Reagan reversed that, and now Bush going down the same road, but the rest of the world is waking up and saying, wait a minute, we've got a problem. And it goes beyond just the problem that we have in Iraq. Of course, we have, you know, Dick Cheney saying things like,
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And everybody's going, oh, interesting, Vice President Cheney. Might that have something to do with something?
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And now we have the story in The Independent. Last week, 200 of the world's leading climate scientists, meeting at Tony Blair's request at the Met Office's new headquarters at Exeter, issued the most urgent warning to date. The most urgent, and there have been some urgent warnings, to date, that dangerous climate change is taking place and that time is running out. This is the headline. And this is not from from National Enquirer type publication. This is The Independent. One of the five major newspapers in the United Kingdom. The headline, Apocalypse Now, : How Mankind is Sleepwalking to the End of the Earth. The subhead, floods, storms, and droughts, melting Arctic ice, shrinking glaciers, oceans turning to acid. The world's top scientists warned last week that dangerous climate change is taking place today, not the day after tomorrow. Last week, 200 of the world's leading climate scientists met, issued an urgent warning, the most urgent warning to date, that dangerous climate change is taking place and that time is running out. The alarms, the Independent notes, this article by Jeffrey Lean, notes the alarms have been going off since the beginning of one of the warmest Januaries on record. Then the biggest ever study of climate change, based at Oxford University, reported that it could prove to be twice as catastrophic, it being climate change, not Oxford University, reported that it could prove to be twice as catastrophic as the IPCC's worst predictions. The IPCC being the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the group of the world's leading climate scientists who for years now, for about a decade, have been saying, look out, folks, there's a problem. There's a real problem. And an international task force, also reporting to Tony Blair and co-chaired by his close ally Stephen Byers, concluded that we could reach, quote, the point of no return, end quote, in a decade. George Bush has actually called Tony Blair up and asked him to stop talking about this. This was in the news. I reported on this program about a month ago. Tony Blair told him to take a leap. The future of the world is at stake here, George, not just your campaign donations. Finally, the UK head of Shell Oil Company, Lord Oxburgh, took time out just before his company reported record profits, mainly achieved by selling oil, one of the main causes of the problem, to warn, now this is the head of Shell Oil, the UK head of Shell Oil, Lord Oxburgh, shows up at this conference to warn that unless governments take action, there will, quote, there will be a disaster, end quote. This from the head of Shell Oil in the UK. Where is the media in America? We'll be right back.
Love guides.
My daughter has a million things going on in her daily life, from softball to band to voice lessons. My husband and I like to make sure she doesn't spend her idle time idle, because an idle mind is a playground for trouble. You see, occupying our daughter's free time and keeping her active makes us feel confident that she won't be hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana.
Paid for by ONDCP.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
The AFL-CIO has chosen not to endorse anyone in a race that some say will determine the future of the Democratic Party. Upon hearing the news, former Texas Congressman Martin Frost, who is depending on an endorsement from the Labor Federation, announced his intent to drop out of the race for chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Union officials say Frost didn't show enough movement to win labor support. The departure of Frost narrows the field to former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, new Democrat Network President Simon Rosenberg, former Indiana Representative Tim Romer, and political consultant Donnie Fowler. Gerald McEntee, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, told the Associated Press that at the AFL-CIO political meeting, some were for Frost and some were for Dean, but the committee decided that it would be best to let individual unions decide for themselves. Many see Frost dropping out as a boost for Fowler, who has tried to position himself as the anti-Dean. While the AFL-CIO has chosen not to endorse anyone, individual unions have begun announcing support for candidates. Just this week, the United Auto Workers and the United Steelworkers of America gave their nods to Howard Dean. The vote will be held in Washington, D.C. on February 12th.
As President Bush brings his Social Security privatization pitch to Midwest states today, including North and South Dakota and Nebraska, the AFL-CIO is joining other progressive groups to rally against it. AFL-CIO Midwest Representative Shelley Zeeberg says that draining money from Social Security into private accounts undermines Social Security while creating as much as $2 trillion in more federal debt. Seberg says not only does Bush's irresponsible scheme not strengthen Social Security, but it undermines it.
Well, the truth of the matter is, under the Bush plan, Social Security would run out of money 14 years sooner than is now expected. And so essentially, this makes Social Security funding problems even worse, not better.
France may soon see an end to its 35-hour work week. While a recent poll shows the majority of French workers don't want to work more, the parliament has begun a three-day debate on the issue. They are debating a bill that would allow workers to clock more than 35 hours a week in return for more pay. The government issued a statement that says a longer work week is important to keep the country's economy stimulated.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. This year, according to Deloitte & Touche, the top 100 global financial services firms will offshore more than $200 billion of their operating costs. TechWeb says offshoring in information tech industries is expected to grow nearly 20% each year through 2008, with the average company sending 60% of its computer application work to low-wage nations by 2009. According to a University of California, Berkeley study, 14 million Americans hold jobs at risk of being outsourced. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Winter Brain Conference and StoryCon in Palm Springs, California. Winter Brain Conference, where some of the world's leading brain scientists get together and work with, talk about, discuss, you know, how does all this stuff work? How do the brain, how do we achieve optimal performance? How do we heal people of trauma? There's a workshop yesterday Anna Wise was doing on spiritual states associated with brainwave functions and brainwave patterns. So there's just a whole spectrum of really fascinating stuff going on here. And yesterday, one of the speakers, I gave a talk yesterday at noon, and the fellow who preceded me, talked for about 40 minutes before I talked, was a fellow from West Point, from the Army War College. And I have with me Rob Call, the fellow who puts on the conference, who also is also the editor of opednews.com. Rob's been on our program before in that capacity. You wear a lot of hats, Rob.
Yeah.
Welcome to the program. The fellow who preceded me yesterday, the guy from the War College, what was his name? I don't recall right off the top of my head.
Nate Zinser,
okay. And I thought that, you know, he was presenting some really interesting stuff. Tell us a little bit about your take on what he was talking about.
Well, I met him at a sports psychology conference. Sports psychology is a field that aims at helping to enable elite athletes and everyday athletes achieve their peak performance.
Right.
He was presenting on his work as the director of West Point's peak performance program, and I found from him that he was using his approaches to train the soldiers. So.
Uh-huh.
The title of his talk was Building the Warrior Ethos, Mental Training for 21st Century Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what my meeting is about is optimal functioning in positive psychology.
Right.
And it looks like he's trained over 10,000 soldiers with this,
yeah.
A lot of them officers who then train others.
Yeah.
So
I found it fascinating that he was talking about creating this mindset of I am a soldier, I don't want to say I am a killing machine, but there was even a component of that in there, but I am committed to my mission, I will leave nobody behind. There was this mantra that they actually had these people reciting.
They have I'm not sure if it's a motto, but it does include that you're going to defend your country and you're not going to leave your mission, you're not going to leave your comrades behind. This has been the Army's motto for a really long time.
Yeah.
I had him there because he's using cutting-edge techniques and approaches to help people to function at their best. And some of it's very practical stuff, goal setting and mental imagery.
Yeah.
He's put together a lot of what many people in the field of sports psychology are doing. And I think that what he's training the soldiers to do can apply just as well to somebody working in a progressive organization to get sure. things done.
Yeah, no, I thought the information that was presented was fascinating. And he sat through my talk, and I started out my talk by pointing out my criticism of his presentation, which was perhaps impolitic, and that was that they had in this mantra that they have these soldiers repeating. You know, when a member of Congress is sworn in, when the president is sworn in, the president doesn't swear that he will defend the United States of America from external aggression or something like that. He says he will defend the Constitution of the United States. And these soldiers, in their mantra, say that they will fight for freedom and the American way of life.
Whoever defines that.
And that, well, that's the problem.
Yes.
And I pointed out, you know, we have now 36% of our high school students saying, well, you know, the American way of life and freedom means that the government should be censoring the news. And I was kind of gently suggesting to him that maybe these soldiers should swear to defend the Constitution. You know, but I found it a fascinating presentation. A number of other things that have gone on here, a number of other presentations. Really cutting edge, breaking new ground. What are some of the ones that you think have been the most interesting?
Well, I think that if people like the movie What the Bleep, which was about quantum physics and consciousness, then they'd really love this conference.
And reality. What is reality? What is the nature of reality?
Yeah. I mean, right now, while we're speaking, there's a panel on, where is it? It's a the brain and physics and how they interact, and that's going to be incredible. Tying together consciousness and what
happens. Is Carl Prebaum on that?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell our listeners about Carl.
Carl's in his 80s now. He was a neurosurgeon researcher at Stanford. In the late 70s, early 80s, he came up with a holographic model of the brain, holographic universe concept of the brain. And he's just done incredible work. His curriculum vitae looks like a paperback book. It's so thick with the articles and studies that he's doing. In his 80s, he's still on the faculty at Georgetown University and still doing research.
Yeah. And he's one of the grand old men of this whole idea that the dividing line between physics, between what seems to be real and what is real, is not where we think it is necessarily, and to a certain extent, what we perceive to be real is really our projection, our creation. I don't want to get too esoteric here in this program, but with regard to politics, I thought it was interesting that you asked me to give a talk about politics at a conference. I mean, I did speak on ADHD, which I've spoken at this conference for a decade now. On the books that I've written about ADHD and neurology and psychology and things like that. And I did a couple of workshops on psychology. But you asked me to give a speech about a return to democracy, what would Jefferson do? And that presentation was actually one of the best attended presentations that I gave and one of the best received. And as far as I know, it was the only event in this entire 4 or 5 day conference that had anything to do at all with politics. What kind of feedback have you been getting? What do you think is going on here? Why is it that the brain scientists want to come listen to some guy rant about democracy?
Well, first of all, it works out that about 99% of the attendees here are progressives. Last year we had Swami Beyondananda as a comedian, and he had a wonderful response. This conference is about inner revolution. Mm-hmm. This conference is about raising consciousness and empowering people to take greater control of their lives, their minds, their hearts, and their spirits. And so the presenters talk about the technology of consciousness, the technology, strategies, and tools of how to do it,
yes.
How to actually do it. This is not a theoretical conference.
Now, there's people down there selling machines that you can hook up to your head and learn how to control your brainwaves.
Yeah, they're neurofeedback or EEG biofeedback machines, and there is a whole technology of that where you can hook it up to your head and learn how to control your brainwaves to either increase your creativity, relax, build your alpha waves or your theta waves, which are associated with intuition and imagination, or decrease distractibility and increase attention. So if you've got a kid with ADD and you don't want to put him on a drug that could set off tics and other problems, then you've got a non-drug alternative. Now, the thing with biofeedback, which is a good chunk of this meeting, is there's a politics to it. The politics is that you don't go to your local doctor's office and walk in and see detail men and women pushing biofeedback sessions like you do with a pharmaceutical company. The pharmaceutical companies spend billions and billions selling their drugs.
Well, biofeedback can't be patented, and it isn't controlled by a couple of very large corporations, and isn't incredibly profitable, where you can just crank out pills all day long.
And you can, it's a process that you learn, and once you learn it, you don't need it anymore. So you just get trained, and once you learn these self-regulation and self-awareness skills, you have them.
Right.
And then you don't need to pay for it anymore. And what kind of pharmaceutical company would want that?
And you think that that's why so many of the people who are in this field are progressives, because they have come up against the very conservative pharmaceutical industry head on and gotten their noses bloody, as it were, trying to get into the marketplace, trying to share what they're doing with psychologists, psychiatrists, physicians, school boards, whatnot, and saying, hey, here's a viable alternative to Ritalin. This stuff really works. Joel Lubar, I had dinner with the night before last year. Brilliant. Well, tell us who Joel is.
Is one of the pioneer who pretty much invented the use of brain biofeedback for treating attention deficit disorder.
Right. And he's how many studies do you think Joel has done that have been peer-reviewed and published?
He's got hundreds of papers in his curriculum vitae.
Yeah. He's a professor at
University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
Right. Okay. And just one of the absolute solid guys in the industry. And yet... let me just go even beyond that. I had breakfast day before yesterday with a fellow. He hasn't given me permission to use his name on the air, and he's an MD, so I'm not going to name him, but you know who I'm talking about. And he's a psychiatrist. He's on the faculty of a medical school in the southwestern United States. And he said that he wanted to do a research study that did not involve researching the value of pharmaceuticals. It wasn't anti-pharmaceutical. It just didn't involve the value of it wouldn't have promoted drugs. And not only did his department head tell him that he would not help him submit this, he would not allow him to submit the request for funding on this, but he told him that if he tried to go ahead with it, he was washed up. I mean, that's it. You know, you're out of here. And this is incredible. I mean, here in medical schools across the country now, you have people, you know, this guy's a psychiatrist. He's got board-certified psychiatrist, a professor of psychiatry in a medical school, and he's being told, if you want to do research or you want to supervise research that doesn't help the pharmaceutical industry, not stuff that's going to hurt it, but just doesn't help it, you're toast.
Well, there's an evil triad in this country. What is it, axis of evil, isn't that what Bush said? It's the pharmaceutical companies. It's the right-wing media, and it's the religious extremists, and they're what are toxifying our nation and putting it at such risk of being something that the rest of the world looks up to as an exemplar. And
well,
as
I would toss the health insurance companies in there as well. Maybe it's a quadrat, but which brings us back to the news of the day. Rob, you're the editor and publisher of Op-Ed News, www.opednews.com. And I suppose you haven't had an opportunity. You've been so busy here with the conference to not really keep up with an awful lot of what's going on in the news. Anything on the top of your mind? Today, George W. presented his budget, so it was pretty...
Oh, I saw he's...
pretty scary stuff.
Pretty Christian way of treating the poor and the
I don't think
sick.
Jesus would recognize it, frankly. He's
yeah.
cutting funding for the poor. He's cutting funding for the sick. He's cutting funding for veterans' hospitals. He's cutting funding for education. It's pretty rare. But he's also cutting taxes for rich people.
Oh, well, then.
Yeah, so, you know, we've got priorities on the right side.
And then we've got the foxes starting to be let loose to guard the hen house with Gonzalez and Condi Rice. They're about to go out there and do their destruction.
Yeah. On the eve of, you know, it's interesting. I read the story in today's paper about Condi Rice in the Middle East. And, you know, I maybe it's just because I'm an optimist. Nixon was able to open China to the United States. I mean, ultimately, we're going to have to decide whether that was a good thing or not. They seem to have taken all our jobs now. But
I don't think that a Democrat could have done that, because the Democrats, if a Democrat had tried to open China, they would have been criticized as being soft on communism. And Nixon's anti-communist credentials were impeccable. I mean, he had made that the cornerstone of his entire political career. And so I wonder if there is an upside to Condi Rice being seen as this kind of maybe out there bizarre warrior queen willing to go to war, willing to lie to people in order to make things happen. Just basically, you know, is political and diplomatic terror a tool that may actually have some positive effect, or is it ultimately going to backfire? Is it ultimately going to corrupt the process so badly that even if it seems to have a short-term positive effect, over the long term, we're going to end up with something worse?
I'm an optimist, too, but I think that what we have to go by what we've seen so far, which is a bunch of lies, incompetence, and failure.
Yeah.
And total efforts to spin losing disasters into something that looks decent. And you just can't keep on doing that. I don't see it. I don't really see it. It's going to help some people. It's going to help the big corporations. That's who it's going to help. You know, one thing, though, is that what I love about this meeting is that there are a lot of people here who are leaders in their fields, who are visionaries, who have positive visions of the future. And they're keeping on going on doing their good work that is going to change the world. And it may not do it in the United States. It may not do it so that it happens totally in this country. But the leaders are doing good things that are going to change the way humanity functions. Yeah. And are going to help us to understand how we do the things we do. The work, the presentations that we had here on the neuroscience of relationships and how different parts of the brain function to affect the way you get along with people,
yeah.
How the brain develops as you learn to, as you have a relationship with your parents.
Let me toss something out here, Rob. Louise and I had a conversation about this yesterday and a few other people. I don't think you were with us when we had this conversation. In my talk yesterday when I followed the Army War College guy, I pointed out that historically, progressives have seen government as a nurturing force, and conservatives have seen government as a constraining force. The idea of conservatives being that human nature is essentially evil, and therefore you have to have hierarchy and constraint. And progressives have seen government have seen people historically as good, and government as a positive force. Do you think that there's in the 10 seconds we have left? Do you think that there some brain wiring has to do with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's actually a predisposition to being conservative or liberal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. We'll have to get into it more some other time. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Len. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channel?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a 4-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. At $4.99 a month per second in each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call now.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa.
Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palisex books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
America's most famous naturalist compromised his broad view of wilderness to obtain a narrow set of goals, according to a Kansas historian. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. John Muir has been called a wilderness prophet, but historian Donald Worster says the naturalist's fight to save places like Yosemite diverted his passion for all wilderness into protecting select natural wonders.
It narrowed and focused on the national parks as the place to go find nature, and particularly the greatest, most beautiful places like the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, Yellowstone. Increasingly, those became, for him, nature. And what lay outside those places was less and less interesting to him.
Worster is an environmental historian at the University of Kansas. He says rich, influential friends, people like Teddy Roosevelt and railroad tycoon Edward Harriman, helped Muir save Yosemite, but he says they also compromised the Scottish immigrants' ideals.
In a way, he became compromised by the wonderful linen sheets that he liked to sleep on in these people's houses, the little boutonniere they brought him in the morning. He became their kind of pet. And they would trot John Muir out and say, now tell us some wonderful stories about dogs and birds in your Scottish brogue. And he would light up and do what he was supposed to do.
Muir eventually helped create the National Park Service and founded the Sierra Club. But Worster says Muir seemed blind to the world outside the parks.
He would rail against greedy people trying to destroy Yosemite National Park. But he'd really connect that up to the economic system, and it was driving environmental change, much of it very destructive, across the entire continent.
In spite of his shortcomings, Muir's legacy is seen by millions of people who visit the national parks each year. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Winter Brain Conference in Palm Springs, California. What's the website for the Brain Conference, Rob?
Brainmeeting.com.
Brainmeeting.com. Great. And opednews.com, of course, your political website, and futurehealth.org, your other large website with all kinds
for biofeedback technology.
Okay. So back to the original question. By the way, just ignore the music. It's not going out over the air. It's just, you're just hearing it in your ears. The question that I'd asked you, and we've got about 2.5-3 minutes here to wrap this up, is it possible, and if so, how? What's the mechanism that being a liberal or being a conservative has something to do with brain wiring?
I believe it. It's not that your brain starts out that way. I don't think it's necessarily by birth, but you only have about 60% of your brain mass at birth. Your brain continues to grow and develop as you grow up. And George Lakoff, who wrote Don't Think About an Elephant, has developed this cognitive model for the right-wingers who tend to be strict father families and liberals who tend to be nurturing mother families. And that nurturing process drastically changes the way the brain works. I've hypothesized about this. A nurturing parent tends to produce a person with well-developed right prefrontal cortex mass and connections to the rest of the brain.
The part of the brain right behind the right forehead.
Yeah. Yes. That part of the brain is what turns you into a person who has good or bad relationships, strong abilities for intimacy. And if you don't have that, then you can even develop what's called attachment disorder and a disconnect between people. You might even think of it as somebody with a cold heart. Yes. And yes. I really think that there's the potential, And I'm not saying all right-wingers are this way, but I think that there's more potential for that to happen. There's more child abuse, I know that, in right-wing type of families.
Yeah, well, and we saw the statistics after the election. In the red states, there's more divorce. It goes on and on. Yeah.
So basically, it's the child rearing. It's the values in the family that really do make a difference, and that change the way the brain grows and develops into an adult.
So when we were sitting here on the break, I asked you about this, and you said something that I thought was just such a great headline, such an great opening comment. You said, it begins when the baby cries.
It begins when the baby cries. Yeah. Because
tell me what that means.
Well, in a strict parent model, you let the baby cry. The baby has to deal with it. And in the nurturing parent model, you connect with that baby. The baby who cries and gets a response feels safety and feels love.
So somebody who was raised in a family where they let the child cry is the kind of person who would look at, you know,
the poor.
Yeah, who would
so
be?
So what? Are there 40 million people who don't have health care? Let them die.
That's right.
They're not working hard enough.
There you go. And whereas somebody who was nurtured when they were a child would be the person who would cross the street, the Samaritan who would cross the street and bind up the wounds and help that person.
There's a neurophysiological developmental pattern for compassion.
A physiology, a particular brain chemistry for compassion.
Yes.
That's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. The amazing stuff that comes out of this conference, the website brainmeeting.com and futurehealth.org and opednews.com. Rob Call has been with us. There you go. The fellow who puts together this conference. So glad to have you here, Rob. Thanks for having us here at the conference, letting us broadcast live from it, putting it together, making it all happen. We do appreciate it. And we'll see you on as one of our best of the rest of the news segments again, too.
Okay.
See you all tomorrow from the People's Republic of Vermont.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business